This time on your weekly Constitutional, religious freedom throughout American history.
On the one hand, I feel like we've come such a long way. Our religious freedom model is really so much more robust than it used to be, and so much more robust, I would argue, than most of the rest of the world, and then the rest of world history. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's an incredible world achievement. It's one of our greatest accomplishments. So it's really alarming when you get to modern day and you start to see these signs of the foundations cracking.
That was Steve Waldman, one of the founders of BeliefNet, and the author of a new book called Sacred Liberty. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about religious freedom.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Religious freedom is at the core of the American experiment. It was among James Madison's primary concerns. He called it freedom of conscience. So today we're going to talk with somebody who knows a little bit about it.
My name is Stephen Waldman, and I'm author of the book Sacred Liberty, which is about the history of the fight over religious freedom. I authored a previous book called Founding Faith, which was about the religious lives and views of the founding fathers. And at the time, I was also the co-founder and CEO of BeliefNet, which was a large multi-faith religion and spirituality website. And then at various other times in my career, I've been a news magazine journalist for Newsweek and U.S. News. And currently, I'm the co-founder of something called Report for America, which is a national service program that places journalists into local newsrooms.
Well, you have an eclectic background, but is it safe to say that you come at your various activities from a fundamentally spiritual perspective?
Certainly fundamentally spiritually interested. Almost everything I've done has been in some way connected to the role of religion or spirituality in public life.
And indeed, that's what BeliefNet is all about, isn't it? Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, BeliefNet was started in 1999 as a multi-faith religion and spirituality platform. And it was unusual because it was not created by a religious organization. It was created by a group of journalists who wanted to cover the topics of religion in public life and also just get people the information that they need for their own religious or spiritual lives. It was a kind of a large community as well as an online magazine.
And it's still out there, still doing that same sort of thing.
It is still out there. Yeah, I'm not connected to them anymore, but it's still going.
All right. Well, tell me about your books. What was the first one about?
Well, Founding Faith really focused on the founding fathers, their views about religion and how it shaped the beginning stages of the fight for religious liberty or the definition of religious liberty. So it did include portraits of five different founders, Jefferson, Adams, Washington, Franklin, and of course, James Madison. But it also talked about the role of religion in the American Revolution, why it was an important part of fueling the American Revolution or the approach to it. It talked about the role that the First Great Awakening played in influencing democratic impulses in the revolutionary period. One of my favorite parts was how the creation of the Continental Army as really the first national institution actually grappled with religious freedom and diversity issues before anything else.
We've touched upon that before on this program, and I know you want to talk about Sacred Liberty, which you've just come out with, and we'll definitely get there, but could you tell us a little bit about the Continental Army and the role that religion played in its formation?
This was really George Washington's great significance in the history of religious freedom was not so much his role as president as it was his role as leader of the Continental Army. Because when you think about it, it really was the first national institution of any size or importance. He had soldiers from all over the country, and there were Catholics from Maryland and Presbyterians from New Jersey and Congregationalists from Massachusetts and Anglicans or Episcopalians from the southern states. And, you know, we may think of these as, well, they're all Christian. What's the big deal?
Just ask the people of Ireland about that.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's exactly right. You know, the differences between religious denominations were enormous. And for example, the Continental Army or some of the soldiers had a practice on Guy Fawkes Day of burning effigies of the Pope.
Oh, dear.
And George Washington reacted very badly to that and said, we're trying to recruit France as our key ally. This could be the difference between winning and losing. And we're also trying to recruit Quebec, the French Canadians. And so for us to be offending Catholicism at the time we're trying to build bridges with these Catholic countries is a terrible idea. So he banned the burning of effigies of the Pope and in general instructed the troops to start being nice and tolerant to Catholics. And in a variety of other ways, started to impose religious freedom or respect for different religions within the army in the way that they chose chaplains, things like that, for practical reasons. I mean, I think he was, you know, believed in the principles as well. But I think mostly what was driving him was, since we have to create an integrated army here, and we need to come up with ways of making people think more as Americans and less as Congregationalists or even New Jerseyans. And religion was a big part of it.
And this was an era when individual colonies, soon to be states, actually would have established churches. And indeed, if we could back up in time a little bit, from the very beginning, many of the people seeking religious freedom in this part of the world were seeking it just for themselves and not for others, weren't they?
Yeah, and when you realize that, you also kind of come to realize that actually we really didn't have religious freedom in any real robust sense for much of our American history because, as you said, a lot of it was people who were fleeing persecution of themselves. But when it came time to applying those principles to other religions, they balked. And that was certainly true. I mean, the Puritans, the pilgrims who came here in part fleeing religious harassment, then turned around and their ancestors hung Quakers from a tree in the Boston Commons for the crime of being a Quaker. There were four Quakers who were executed for that crime.
And Roger Williams got exiled from the Massachusetts Bay Colony, didn't he?
There's Dan Hutchinson, and you know there was very little. Their view was the notion of creating a city on a hill. The city on the hill was not New York City. It was not supposed to be a kind of pluralist melting pot. It was supposed to be a model of Christian purity. It was supposed to be showing here's what we can do if we create a pure Christian land, as defined by this one particular group. So they really did not take kindly to people that they thought were ruining that plan.
Right. So from the early 1600s, when British North America was getting itself started, right up to the Revolution, about 169 years between Jamestown and the Declaration of Independence, what we had was a patchwork of established religions, all of them eyeing each other warily and frequently throughout that period persecuting one another. And that's what George Washington inherited when he was trying to put together this Continental Army.
Exactly. So it was a big deal that he promoted Catholics in the army, gave them big positions. You know, he had Catholic soldiers fighting in key battles, and whatever principles he might have had around that became less important than the reality of creating an integrated army. And the other way you can look at those 150 plus years is a series of experiments, because we had each colony was a little bit different. You know, in there were often established churches. They were different established churches in effect. Like in the New England states, it tended to be the Congregational Church that had the power of the state.
And that's the one that started out as the Puritans, right?
Yes, okay. Exactly. It's sort of the derived from that. Mm-hmm. And then in this a lot of the southern colonies, it was the Church of England, the Anglican Church. But even in Pennsylvania was such an interesting case because it in many ways pioneered religious freedom. But even they had this period where the legislature and the governor's office were occupied by Quakers, and they essentially promoted Quaker views on things, including pacifism. And once the Pennsylvanians on the western part of the state started getting massacred in Indian wars, they said, your religious views, you Quakers, are ruining our lives, and we don't want Quakerism as the, you know, the state religion either. It wasn't quite a state religion, but it even gave this little sense of, like, even a religion like Quakerism that actually was emphasizing tolerance ran into problems when they became kind of the semi-official religion. And so you basically got to the constitutional period.
Before we leave that, one other thing. Sure. I've heard that George Washington was a bit miffed at the Quakers because many of them refused to join the Continental Army, and he had to come to terms with that later, didn't he?
Yeah, and it was really the first, and many Quakers also allied themselves with the British. So there were both of those reasons made Quakers often not terribly popular during that era. But it also forced, it was kind of the first case of conscientious objection, of the idea that religious groups should be given exemptions from certain laws that violate their conscience. And even though it didn't go down that well, basically the founders collectively kind of went along with that idea that Quakers should be allowed to avoid military service. And it became an important principle that would come back later in the history of religious freedom, that we sometimes allow religions to become exempt from certain laws that other people are abiding by.
A major issue even today. Before we leave founding faith, one other thing. We've talked a lot in the show about Jefferson and Madison's religious views, and we've just now covered George Washington. I haven't really talked a lot about John Adams or Benjamin Franklin. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about their views on religion and religious freedom.
Yeah. Well, they're all a little bit different. And I think, you know, I used to be a political reporter, so forgive me for kind of reverting to form a little bit here. But I almost think if I were writing a kind of modern political article about the religious views of the founding fathers, I would break them up into caucuses that basically there's sort of the Enlightenment caucus, you might call it, that where I would say is Jefferson, Franklin, Tom Paine. And these are people who really emphasized freedom of inquiry, the freedom of the mind. Mm-hmm. And their approach to religious freedom tended to be about preventing religion from infringing upon that intellectual inquiry. Not that they were atheists, but their emphasis was definitely on the freedom of the mind, and the famous line from Jefferson from the Statute of Religious Freedom was that that God's greatest gift was the freedom to think. I'm paraphrasing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's something along the lines, whereas Almighty God has made the mind of man free. And I'm not looking at it right now, so that's probably a little bit off. But it's a little bit closer, yeah. And I always found that to be a very stirring and very unusual line for the beginning of a statute.
Yeah, and it gives you a window into what his emphasis was when he was talking about religious freedom. And it turns out that's a little bit different from Madison's and some of the others. And so you have the Enlightenment caucus on one hand. On the other end of the spectrum, I would say you have the traditionalists.
Well, wait a second. Before we leave that, I always thought Madison was pretty much in the same camp as Jefferson on that.
I don't think so. I think there's really some very important differences between Madison and Jefferson on religious freedom.
And we'll go into what some of those differences are when we come back. It's Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And today my guest is Steve Waldman, who previously founded something called BeliefNet Online about spirituality and religion. He's continued in that vein with a recent publication called Sacred Liberty. Before the break, we were talking about the differences between the founders on the topic of religious freedom, and Steve thinks there's actually some daylight between Thomas Jefferson and James Madison.
That's a deep topic that we'll dive into. Let me come back to that for a second.
Okay.
I want to set up the other caucuses because I think it helps explain and situate Madison in a slightly different place than Jefferson. On the so then on the other end of the spectrum, you have sort of traditionalists. Those are folks who basically while not wanting persecution, were very comfortable with there being official religions in the colonies. With extra tolerance thrown in, to be sure, but basically they were fine and supportive of the idea that in order for religion to thrive, you needed to have the state actively support it.
Patrick Henry was the head of that, wasn't he?
Yeah, and Patrick Henry, interestingly, was one of the big advocates for that. And there were and a lot of the clergy in New England supported that. Then I think there's the middle group is what I might call religious freedom centrists, and I would put Washington and John Adams in that group. And they mostly embraced the religious freedom ideas of the First Amendment and that Jefferson and Madison were arguing for, but they believed in a strong public religion element, meaning prayer proclamations from the president and lots of religious language in their statements and speeches. And Adams actually supported having a light religious establishment in Massachusetts for many, many years. But the key is, like, if you look at the inaugural addresses of Adams and Washington, they're very different than the speeches of Jefferson and Madison. They issued prayer proclamations from, in effect, the office of the president, calling the nation to prayer. And when Jefferson got there, he said, we're not going to do that anymore. That's not an appropriate use of government. That's a violation of the First Amendment. So now the reason I think that I put Madison in a kind of category of his own and why he is sort of the hero of my book of Sacred Liberty is that I think he was the one who bridged these different groups. He had a philosophy that that drew together different parts of the public consciousness and different political groups. And I should mention one other group that isn't a political group, but it's an important player in this, which is the evangelical Christians and the religious dissenters. They were really important players in this. And in Virginia, one of the most consequential, you know, accidents of history was that there was a massive wave of persecution against Baptists in Virginia, something like 150 arrests of ministers. Almost half of the ministers, of the Baptist ministers in Virginia, were arrested by the time of the American Revolution. And it was just brutal persecution. There was a case of one minister who's standing up there preaching, and an Anglican minister comes in and goes up to the pulpit, jams the butt end of a whip into his mouth to stop him from talking, and then they drag him out to the fields and have him beaten up. They throw hornets' nests into the churches, into the Baptist churches. There was another one who was imprisoned and was trying to preach from the prison windows, and they would some of the people outside are urinating in his face to stop him from doing it. It's really ugly persecution during this time. And
Steve, let me interrupt you there. Those stories are so important, and those unpleasant details. I'm not singling out Baptists, but you mentioned that they were undergoing persecution. So when I hear modern-day Baptists or modern-day evangelicals arguing for what seems to be more of an establishment of religion, I sometimes wonder if they realize that those things can go both ways and that they were at one time the people being persecuted.
Well, this is one of the big messages of my book, and I speak to evangelical groups all the time and say no group did more to advance religious freedom in the big sweep of American history than evangelical Christians.
Yes.
And I do believe that they're often on the wrong side of history now, and I encourage them to reclaim their leadership role by tapping into and understanding the history of their ancestors and the role that they played in religious freedom, which emphasized tolerance and pluralism in a way that they're not right now. Mm-hmm. So that was very, very informative for Madison. So you had this wave of persecution, which was bad in itself, but it became historically significant because it happened within a horse ride of James Madison's house. Madison was very aware of the persecution that was going on in the area. He referenced Baptist ministers being imprisoned in the neighboring county of Culpeper County for the crime of what he called was just publishing their sentiments. And there's even some evidence that he may have helped defend some of them in court. And in general, became very entwined with the fate of evangelicals in Virginia. Some of the most fascinating parts of this for me, because you tend to not think of the founding fathers as political. You know, they kind of operate on this lofty plane where they write important thoughts and it just goes straight to the National Archive.
Right, because they're all made of marble and they lived on pedestals.
Exactly. And so the thought that Madison, you know, had to run for Congress and had to go around giving speeches and making campaign promises and politicking, which he didn't really like doing, but he had to, is fascinating to me. And that a key part of the politicking for Madison had to do with religious freedom. There was this wonderful moment where, you know, they've established the Constitution, thanks in part to Madison, large part. And then Madison goes back to Virginia to run for Congress. And Patrick Henry, who becomes kind of his nemesis during this period, and doesn't like Madison and his approach to the Constitution, blocks him from being appointed to the Senate. And then he attempts to block him from winning a congressional seat also by essentially gerrymandering. Ironically, this is a moment when Eldridge Gerry himself was there doing the gerrymandering. But in this case, it was Patrick Henry who carved out a district for Madison that was full of Baptists and evangelical Christians, what we would now call evangelical Christians, and thinking that that would do it. And they also started to spread the rumor that Madison had lost interest in religious freedom. He didn't care about it anymore. And the proof was that he wasn't pushing for a Bill of Rights, which is true, he wasn't. He didn't think it was necessary or a good idea. So they spread, you know, he's telling the Baptists, he's no friend of religious freedom. Vote for James Monroe, is the opponent. And Madison finally realized he had to do something about it. He didn't really like politicking, but he realized he was about to lose his election for Congress. You can imagine how history might have turned out a little bit differently had he lost this election. So he goes back to Virginia and meets with Baptist leaders and essentially makes what is probably one of the most important campaign promises in American history. It says, if you support me, I will propose a Bill of Rights. And they do support him. He wins by a few hundred votes. And he goes off to Congress and proposes what becomes the First Amendment and the rest of the Bill of Rights. So he has this strong relationship that is a mix of being sympathetic to their plight, being appreciative of their votes, and I think also being understanding of their theology, the Baptist theology. It wasn't just that they wanted separation of church and state because they didn't want to be persecuted themselves. It actually grew out of their theology, which encouraged a much more direct relationship with God, and that you didn't need support from the government and that you didn't need intermediaries, even necessarily of churches. So Madison, going back to our little template of different political groups, the caucuses, if you were, Madison played this important role of stitching together this coalition that included people like Jefferson, but it also included the evangelicals, who culturally couldn't be more different than Thomas Jefferson or Tom Paine or Benjamin Franklin. And he created a doctrine as well as a political coalition that essentially tied together these different constituencies.
Okay, now Steve, I understand where you're coming from. James Madison was always the practical politician to Jefferson's philosopher. And so you're saying through his political activities and the necessity of compromise, he's the one who's bridging the gaps between these various factions.
Yeah, and he bridges it not just in the way, you know, I don't know, Lyndon Johnson would bridge it by counting votes and saying we need some of these guys and some of those guys. He also comes up with a theory that ties them together. And I sort of summarize the Madisonian theory as having two key parts. The first part is the idea that the best way to encourage religion is to leave it alone. And that is sometimes, you know, ends up being about separation of church and state. It's a little broader than that. But at the time, that was a radical idea. We sort of take that one for granted right now. But we should remember that for most of world history and most of American history, that was not the approach that people took. They sort of thought, yeah, religion is really important. We have to encourage it. If you want to encourage something, you have the government get in there and do stuff, you know, have them tax people and help pay for the salaries of the ministers, or give them land so they can build churches. And Madison's view was that that would backfire, so that even well-intentioned efforts to help a particular religion will backfire. So he didn't just oppose persecution. He opposed efforts to subsidize religion, even when they were sort of liberal-minded. So that's first part. The second part of Madison's philosophy was that he was skeptical of what he called parchment barriers, which were sort of lofty declarations of rights of the sort that Jefferson was especially good at. He said the real way to guarantee religious freedom was through a multiplicity of sects, S-E-C-T-S. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's just a religious version of his approach to the balance of powers in politics, that basically if you have power dispersed in the political sense, meaning have it dispersed among different institutions, have it dispersed among the different states around the country, you're less likely to have tyranny consolidate in the form of one person or one state. He basically had the same views about religion, that if you had a multiplicity of different religions or denominations, it would prevent one religion from becoming so strong that it could oppress the other religions. He understood that the threat to religious freedom didn't just come from government. It also could come from religion itself or from state legislatures. That, you know, you have an area in New England, the oppression for the most part of the Baptists came from the Congregationalists and the power that they could exert. So Madison had this second thrust to his thinking that was all about having this kind of pluralism, what we would now call pluralism. That wasn't the word they used then, but basically that's what it was, and that the more fragmented things were, the better, which is a kind of unusual way of looking at it.
But again, very, so very, very practical.
Really came through the rest of history.
Understood. Well, that actually brings us, we've been talking about your first book, Founding Faith, and wow, you covered a lot of territory in that one. But of course, you've just published Sacred Liberty. My first question to you about Sacred Liberty is, why did you feel it necessary to do a second book when you'd already covered so much ground about American religious freedom in your first book?
I felt a little guilty.
Guilty?
I wrote Founding Faith and then subsequently realized I had fallen into the same trap that many people do, and which is to think that if you figure out the Founding Fathers, you've figured out everything, and that, you know, American history pretty much stops there, or more accurately, like you jump from the Founding Fathers to the 21st century, mm-hmm. and that's pretty much all you need to know. And the fact is that with religious freedom, it was really a lot like the civil rights movement for African Americans. You wouldn't say, oh, you know, we had all men are created equal in the Declaration of Independence, therefore blacks got civil rights. Like, we know that actually it was many hundreds of years fight to take those principles and actually make them real. And that's what's happened with religious freedom too. The principles that were established in the First Amendment were crucial, but they really didn't provide religious freedom in a pervasive way. It took another 200 years to develop real religious freedom, and it often took bloody, brutal fights and massive waves of persecution, because we really didn't have religious freedom in many ways, even after the First Amendment was passed. So the story of Sacred Liberty, which does still has start off with Madison and setting the foundation there, but it then goes on from there to say, okay, we had some principles established, but they really weren't in place in many parts of the country. How did we get from there to current day, where we do have a very robust model of religious freedom compared to the rest of the world, and for most of world history. We can come back and talk about, you know, the modern threats, but by and large, the book is about how religious freedom, or our model of it, became America's greatest invention. And you have to go through a few hundred years of persecution of Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and Catholics and others to really earn our way to the more robust model of religious freedom.
Well, take us through a few of your constitutional heroes here, and let's try to do it chronologically. What was the first big incident after the founding era?
Well, the persecution of Catholics was much more severe and pervasive than I realized. I mean, this was, to quote the tech world people, anti-Catholicism was a feature, not a bug, of the American experiment. You know, it really started early.
Didn't John Jay say that when he drafted the Constitution for the state of New York, it was designed to put up a wall around the state to keep out the Catholics?
I actually didn't know that, but that's totally in keeping with most of these founding fathers who on the one hand are eloquent about the rights of men and religious freedom, said horrible things about Catholics. Alexander Hamilton said that they were going to destroy the country, destroy our freedom, because Britain had deigned to give some religious rights to Catholics in Canada. And John Adams called them the monster of the Catholic Church and the whore of Babylon. And they, you know, remember, it wasn't that long after the religious Protestant Catholic religious wars of Europe, and they, on some level, America was settled as a bulwark against Catholicism. So that persists into the 19th century, where you start to have the differences that in the beginning, in the colonial period, the anti-Catholicism is a little bit theoretical. It's like a fear of what's happening over there in Europe coming over here.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm having a perfectly fascinating discussion with Steve Waldman, the founder of BeliefNet and the author of a new book called Sacred Liberty. Stick around. And now let's finish our discussion with Steve Waldman. We've been talking about religious liberty in the United States, even before we were the United States. And it turns out that, as so often happens in constitutional law, we set out lofty goals and then have difficulty living up to them.
When you start to get to the 1830s, you have actual immigrants, actual Catholic immigrants coming from Ireland. And then it takes on a whole different tone and violent. You have the burning down convents and churches. In Charleston, Massachusetts, in the 1830s, a mob burns down the Ursuline Convent and plunders the crypts of deceased nuns, keeping teeth and crosses as souvenirs.
Oh,
and then
dear.
You have the Bible riots in Philadelphia a little while later, where Protestants who wanted to force Catholics to read the Protestant edition of the translation of the Bible in the schools, 30 people died in the riots in Philadelphia.
They had to call out the militia, and they went and got cannon and shot them at each other.
Yeah, it was a real war.
Exactly. I always call the Bible riots the Bible wars, because they were, you know, fix bayonets and charge each other and burn down churches. It was amazing.
It really was. And you know, one of the big issues was around the schools.
Yes.
And, you know, it was not controversial to teach the Bible in the schools. Actually, both Catholics and Protestants wanted to do that. But the Protestants said, yeah, we should teach the Bible, by which we mean the Protestant Bible. And Catholics said, we're fine having the Bible taught. We actually want that. But we should be allowed to use a Catholic translation. And the Protestant majority just hated that idea and thought it was giving credibility to what ultimately was a fraudulent and dangerous faith. Anti-Catholic laws were stayed on the books in terms of office holder, you know, whether Catholics could hold office. Mm-hmm. So I think the anti-Catholic sentiment, which, you know, kind of persisted throughout the next 150 years or so, but was particularly had peaks during the 1830s and 40s, and then again when the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, reasserted itself in the 1920s and when waves of immigration happened in the 1870s. Another group whose persecution was really, really notable was Mormons. And I knew in general that Mormons had been persecuted, but the depth and nature of it really is shocking. I mean, the governor of Missouri issued an order calling for the extermination of Mormons in Missouri. This is a genocide order by the governor of Missouri. And not too long after that was one of the worst religious massacres in American history, the Hawn's Mill Massacre in Missouri, where town leaders went to this Mormon community and just mowed them down, killed, I think, 19 people, and eventually drove the Mormons off into Utah, to the West, where the persecution continued in other ways. At one point, the President Buchanan sent the U.S. Army to enforce laws against Mormons. And toward the end of the century, congressional efforts to stamp out polygamy, which was part of the Mormon creed, led to about 1,000 Mormons being arrested for the crime of polygamy. But the Congress didn't just stop at banning polygamy. They used that as a moment to try to destroy Mormonism as a religion. They actually literally passed laws that said disincorporated the church, or said it wasn't allowed to own land for worth more than $50,000. They tried to uproot the religion in general. There's an amazing photo of the leaders of the Mormon church, the elders, sitting in a prison yard in striped uniforms, having been rounded up and imprisoned. I looked also at Native Americans and slaves who we tend to forget about in the story of religious freedom, in part because they had so many other freedoms that were being denied that we sometimes forget this one. And in the case of Native Americans, it was what I focused on in my book was this fascinating period after the Civil War, when the quote-unquote good guys, the reformers, were the ones who said, we, instead of exterminating the Indians, we should civilize them by converting them to Christianity. And you may have heard of the schools, the immersion schools, boarding schools that many Native American children were taken to. And what's often forgotten in that is that one of the points of those and one of the outcomes of those was to purge them of their Native American religions and convert them all to Christianity. And that was what happened. You know, they were, their Native practice was not allowed, and they were all taught Christian religious practice pervasively. And in a kind of weird, dark, almost darkly comical into that, the way that that policy ended was that the Protestants started to get annoyed that the Catholics were getting a lot of the contracts to run the Indian schools, and they started to worry that the Catholics were getting a head start on them in the conversion of Indian business. And so they then changed their minds and said, this isn't a good idea to have religions do this anymore. And they pulled back. So
that is darkly comical, isn't it?
Remarkable. There's amazing quotes where they say, the Native Americans deserve to have religious freedom, by which they meant the freedom to choose between Protestants or Catholics.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Hey, you mentioned the KKK. And again, we often identify them with lynchings of black people. But there were religious bigotries there, too, primarily, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, directed against Catholics. Talk to us a little bit about that. Was that primarily the second Klan in the early 20th century?
Yes, it's the second incarnation of the Klan that happens in the 1920s, where the emphasis is as much on opposing Catholics as it is on attacking blacks. And this is after a period of massive immigration of Catholics from Europe, from Ireland in particular. And they are very, very strong in states like Indiana, Ohio, Washington State, Maine. It's not even really primarily based in the South. And it was astonishing levels of anti-Catholic bigotry. And they... they would spread the word in all sorts of odd ways. One of the weirdest ones, honestly, was that they had glee clubs.
I was going to ask you about the glee clubs because that really caught my eye. KKK glee clubs. Tell me about those.
Yeah, KKK glee clubs. And they would sing at picnics and other events like that. And they had their KKK songbooks. And many of the lyrics in these KKK songbooks were anti-Catholic songs. There was one to the tune of "Yes, we have no bananas," where the lyrics were "Yes, we have no Catholics."
Oh dear!
And they.
I hate to laugh at these things because, of course, they're horrible, but they're also darkly comic, to borrow your phrase.
Yeah, I had the same feeling. I just couldn't believe when I was reading these. But you're right; it does get dark because they're also going around burning gigantic crosses in the neighborhoods of Catholics. And it kind of came to a head with the election campaign of Al Smith in 1928 when he's Catholic from New York. He kind of pushes all the buttons. He's an Catholic immigrant, Irish and Italian ancestry, in favor of against prohibition. And the KKK is at full gear. And they had attained real power in some states. There were some governors who were KKK members. Several hundred of the delegates to the Democratic Convention in 1928 were KKK members.
Openly.
Just some of the propaganda was amazing. There was one of the things they circulated was a picture, a photograph of the Holland Tunnel in New York City, which had just been built. And they said that that was the tunnel that the Vatican had built so that the Pope could come over to the U.S. to run the country more easily. So it was that kind of thing, and it was really pervasive. And in fact, it wasn't just in the members in New York City and Queens. There were anti-Catholic marches, including one in 27, I think, that was part of a Memorial Day parade. And we have heard about this a little bit because. There was an altercation between the Klan and the New York City police, and a half dozen people were arrested. One of the people who were arrested was Donald Trump's father.
Oh.
And it's a little ambiguous from the press accounts back then of whether he was one of the Klansmen, or he was sympathetic, or he was just a innocent bystander who got caught up in it. But he was arrested along with a bunch of KKK members and then his charges were dismissed, I should say.
Well, Steve,
so
you
don't
you
really
meant...
know what he was doing there. But, you know, it's just, again, it was like the Klan, which we tend to think of as being focused in the South, had great strength in the Northeastern and Midwestern states around anti-Catholicism.
Steve, you mentioned the T word, Trump, and that reminds me that we're getting short on time and that we want to talk at least a little bit about what's going on right now in 2019. So could you fast forward and tell us what your concerns are about the present era?
My first concern is that the attacks on American Muslims are really severe and echoing a lot of the worst attacks that we saw earlier in American history. So, you know, when Trump in the 2016 campaign proposed a ban on Muslims entering the country, that was unprecedented. I mean, for all the horrible religious freedom things that I write about in the book, we actually had never had a president or presidential candidate who was successful make an attack on one particular religion such a central part of his campaign. And the idea of creating an anti-Muslim registry was also unprecedented as a religious matter anyway. And there was a point in 2015, there was a poll that said only half of Republicans were willing to say that Islam should be legal as a religion in America. And I just sort of saw that. And this was one of the reasons I decided this would be a good time to write this book. Not that I wanted to do a current events book, but that it's important that we understand the history of religious freedom and how we got it so that we don't squander it. And what concerned me was that some of the really basic foundations of religious freedom, the foundations seem to be much more fragile than we would think. And you can see some of the things that are said about Muslims in modern times are very similar to what was said about Catholics and Mormons. For instance, you often hear, well, Islam isn't really a religion. And that was said about Catholics and Mormons. And it's not really religion, it's a political system. In the case of Catholics, it's a political system run by the Pope. It's often said about Muslims as well. And the reason that is said is because then you don't have to give them First Amendment protections if it's not a religion. Or they would be cast as alien. You know, the Irish Catholics, there were these amazing cartoons of Irish immigrants done by Thomas Nast, one of the most popular political cartoonists of the 1870s, and they were drawn to look like blacks. In order to make them seem not white and seem other. And
I can't resist pointing out that as we're speaking here in July of 2019, just recently in the headlines have been a series of tweets where our president has suggested that certain members of Congress, specifically some liberal Democratic women who are people of color, go back to where they came from. That sounds to
me. Isn't that amazing? So it's really this notion of turning them into the other and saying that they're foreign. The foreignness of it is really important. And we think, you know, with Mormons, it's certainly.
And I have to point out here that every single one of them is an American citizen. And to the extent it makes any difference, three out of the four of them were born here. The fourth was, I believe, naturalized as a child at the age of 10. I mean, these are American citizens. They are from here. So this seems quite consistent with what you've been saying.
Yeah, and you have these periods where the when you're attacking a minority group, whether it's ethnic or religious, but part of the playbook is to cast them as being foreign. So it happened with Mormons, where they were cast as being foreign and Asian. They were referred to as Asiatic, the Mormons, which is sort of funny because there's so much humor out there about Mormons being the whitest people in America, but the idea that they were
Asiatic,
considered not white, as one of the Mormon leaders sort of mused, he said, "It appears that we are not considered to be white people." But it was part of the same thing. It helps to create them as alien, not supportive of our democracy, not supportive of our country. So it's on the one hand, I feel like we've come such a long way. I mean, our religious freedom model is really so much more robust than it used to be, and so much more robust, I would argue, than most of the rest of the world. And then the rest of world history. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's an incredible world achievement. It's one of our greatest accomplishments. So it's really alarming when you get to modern day and you start to see these signs of the foundations cracking.
It's very concerning, but you can also look back at our history and say we've been here before and we got through it before. And now it's almost absurd to think about people actively persecuting Baptists or Catholics or Mormons. So perhaps we'll get to that same place when it comes to Muslims or other religious minorities.
Right. I think that is that's a good, encouraging, optimistic way of looking at it. And of course, part of why we did get through those periods is that the people of those eras rose to the challenge and fought for that religious freedom. So that will have to happen again.
Well, that's why we're doing this interview. And that is, I'm sure, to some extent, why you wrote your book. Once again, what's the title?
Sacred Liberty, America's Long, Bloody, and Ongoing Struggle for Religious Freedom.
I think that title says it all. Steve Waldman, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And for keeping the flame for James Madison getting the credit he deserves.
Well, we love Jimmy around here, and not just because Montpelier underwrites the show, but because he is worthy of that kind of sentiment. Once again, thanks.
I agree. Thank you.
Well, there's no better view than across the table in the sound booth at Claude Moore Hall, at the Center for the Constitution, at James Madison's Montpelier, because opposite me sits the quiz gal, always smiling, always happy, always enthusiastic. How are you today, Emily?
I'm great, Stuart. How are you?
Fine. Do we have a contestant on the line?
Hi, yes. I'm Kevin.
Kevin, where are you from?
I'm from Richmond, Virginia.
Richmond, Virginia. Well, welcome to the show. Emily, let's get to it.
Okay. So thinking back to the Philadelphia Convention, What was an outcome of the Great Compromise in the framing of the Constitution? Mm. All right. Option A, it provided for 2-year terms for the House, but made Senate terms 6 years. B, it delegated all powers to the states not explicitly granted to the federal government in the Constitution. C, it outlined the country's plan for expansion. Or D, it guaranteed states equal representation in the Senate, but based representation on proportional population in the House.
I think the answer is D. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's the last one.
D as in dog. And what was that one?
It guaranteed states equal representation in the Senate, but based representation on proportional population in the House.
So that was the Great Compromise. You're sure?
No, but that's my guess.
That's your best guess. All right, Emily, is it a good guess?
It is, yeah.
It's an excellent guess, Kevin. That's exactly the issue.
Awesome.
Absolutely. Well done. Under the predecessor to our Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, every state had an equal vote in the Congress. And states like Virginia didn't like the idea that as they grew both in population and possibly in size, because many of them had claims of territory to the West, that they would have only the same voice that states like Rhode Island or Connecticut, and which is going to have a smaller population simply because it's a smaller place. They didn't want equal representation. They wanted proportional, and that was the compromise. The compromise was half of Congress is proportional. That's a House of Representatives, and half of it is everybody's equal. And to this day, the Senate, which was the subject of that compromise, is controversial because people still get irritated that somebody from Wyoming has two senators, just like somebody from California, even though there's a tiny you could probably fill up a small size city in California with the entire population of the state of Wyoming. And so that issue remains with us today, but that's how we got our Constitution, or one of the main ways. So congratulations to you, and get on Facebook, look up Your Weekly Constitutional, send us a message, give us your t-shirt size and your mailing address, and we will put one in the mail to you along with a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you, too. And thank you, Emily, for that excellent question.
All right. Thanks, Stuart. And remember, We the People includes girls, too.
Yes, it does. And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Steve Waldman, one of the founders of BeliefNet and the author of the new book, Sacred Liberty. Go out and buy a copy. I think you'll enjoy it. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment. Even if you are a Catholic, or a Mormon, or a Muslim, or maybe an atheist.